I guess that's the choice, you know, either you become successful, you know, without principles, or you stick to your principles,
and you're not,
you know,
not successful.
And you're, the establishment is never going to let you rise, you know, and that's just the story of my life.
Episode 27 of the Educated Guest Podcast. I missed you guys. Hashtag Caesar does it on them Twitters and Mr. Underscore A-Y-Y-Y.
What up, what up, what up? This episode is unofficially sponsored by the good folks over at Southwest Patients Group, the best place in San Ysidro or in South County to get your medicinal or recreational needs.
Tonight's episode, I want to thank the unofficial official producer of the Educated Guest Podcast, Mr. Filiberto Gonzalez. He hooked us up with tonight's guest. He's a board member out of Santa Monica. He goes by the name of Oscar De La Torre.
Super dope.
This man has so much knowledge that you just have to listen to the episode in all its entirety. An hour and a half of rich content.
It was a trip because it's actually a three, almost 4 hour interview. So we cut out a lot. They might have to do another episode, but
it was so tough to take the scissors to this one. That's why this episode took so long to get out to you guys. I really hope you enjoy all of his knowledge as a board member, as a community member, just trying to do something better for his neighborhood of Pico. It's a small neighborhood in Santa Monica. And he tells a story of how he came to be a voice, a strong voice for that community. And we really hope you enjoy this episode.
Let's get into it.
You don't seem like an atypical board member.
Yeah. Well, you know, all of us are a product of our time and our community, you know. So for me, growing up on the West Side, especially in Santa Monica's Pico neighborhood, there was a lot of influence. We grew up real close with African American, you know, our black brothers and sisters. So the first time I saw someone pop lock, you know, I was like, wow, you know, that was a trip, you know. I just hit the young man up who I first saw, you know, pop locking. I'm like, where'd you learn it from, you know? Because he's the one that taught me. Yeah. This dude named Cat, Lance Creighton. And then he told me, well, my dad, you know, used to hang out in Venice. And there was the Oakwood neighborhood over there. So he told me, he's like, yeah, you know, I saw these dudes popping. And that's what, you know, where I got the idea from. He brought it to my block on 16th Street. And I saw him popping. I was like, oh, that was cool. I want to learn. So I started practicing with him, you know. And that's how I was introduced to hip-hop, you know, hip-hop culture. It was really through the dance. What's beautiful about hip-hop culture is that it has a battle component to every element. You know, so if you have beef with a dancer, it's like, let's break dance, let's battle. You know, graffiti, you can battle with graffiti art or DJing or MCing or popping or breakdancing. You know, there's a battle component. So the young people in the hood have an outlet, you know, to get that stress out, you know,
to do it, yeah.
and then to shake hands afterwards, because we would, you know, it wasn't like, oh, you know, that guy beat you, and then you'd feel bad about it, you know. You'd be like, man, that dude's good, I, you know, respect, mad props, you know,
right,
what I'm saying,
right,
like,
right, right.
Hey, where do you practice? Let's get together, you know. It was always about, you know, I lost this, you know, like kung fu fight,
yeah.
But this guy's got some skills, you know, and I can learn something from him, you know. Hip hop was about peace, you know, and unity, you know. So we didn't really know peace, love, unity, and having fun. We didn't understand all that, you know.
Right.
When we developed our organization here, it became peace, unity, and social justice.
Mm.
Without even knowing that it was, you know, that those elements.
The tenets of hip hop.
So it just says, you know, like something about the universe, you know, with kids coming from low income environments, that peace and unity are central, you know, to their well being. Mm-hmm. Like if you're not talking about peace and unity, you're missing a whole lot, you know, in terms of how to help out, you know, low income, you know, youth, you know, and definitely in the United States.
Nice.
As we did our research for this episode, you know, we kind of saw that there was this history of organizing and activism in Pico, kind of in the way that you came to be a voice for your community and became an elected board member. You talk about that just a little bit. I mean,
yeah. So what's interesting, you know, there was a sequence of events. I graduated in August of 98. So then, finishing my master's degree, I'm looking for a job, you know. So I'm in August of 98, looking around. In September, you know, I walked into the principal's office in September at Santa Monica High, Dr. Sylvie Rousseau. And, you know, after about an hour, she said, can you start on Monday? It was a Friday. And she's like, and I'm like, well, I guess yes. You know, it's hard to say no to her. And so we, so I started working at the high school in September of 98. And then in October of 98, a gang war breaks out. So we have, the first homicide happened, a 22-year-old Omar Sevilla was killed right across the street from Santa Monica High School on 6th and Pico. And to make a long story short, it led to 2 weeks of violence. And in those 2 weeks, we had 4 homicides and 5 shootings. So 9 separate incidents of gun violence.
Wow.
Between the Pico neighborhood in Santa Monica and then, you know, the Culver City, you know, Mar Vista housing projects. And so, you know, that was, that changed my life, because it's like either you do something about this problem, you get involved, or you don't. And it was difficult because a lot of people were like, man, you can't get rid of gangs. Gangs have been forever. The violence has always been around. Mm-hmm. So that just changed my life, because that led to the Vigil for Peace. You know, we organized a 1,000 people march in November of 98 in response to the violence. And then from there, we went from 1,000 people marching to 85 people meeting to talk. We formed the Forum on Youth Violence and Social Justice. So we framed it as youth violence, not gang violence, and then social justice, because we wanted to talk about the root cause of the problem.
Right, right.
And then from there, it led to us, 15 of us, going to City Hall and making a demand and saying, you know, it's outrageous that we have a gang problem in one of the wealthiest cities in the world when poverty and marginalization are the root cause of gangs.
Mm.
And so when we made that appeal, the city put out an RFP. Anyway, long story short, we ended up opening up our youth center in 2002. So figure that it took 4 years of planning, organizing, activism. It was a big fight. It's a sad story, too, because the city pitted groups against each other. So the city staff pitted blacks against Latinos, you know. And anyway, long story short, we opened up the youth center after 4 years of hard work. And once we opened up the youth center, one of the first issues that came to us was police abuse. So, you know, this whole school to prison pipeline. We started
at the very inception of it, huh?
Exactly. You guys were there. So in 2002, you know, we opened up in like January of 2002, and by March of 2002, a hundred mothers and mostly moms. You know, we formed a group called Mothers for Justice.
Wow.
And this group of mothers organized 100 people protest at the school board meeting.
Nice.
Because the police were coming on campus and arresting black and Latino youth. And this was right after Columbine. So, you know, administrators were acquiesing to law enforcement.
Yeah.
I mean, usually that's what happens. Law enforcement comes on the campus. The principal's like, okay, you can do whatever you want.
Right, right.
Instead of protecting the rights of the students. So we had at least 3 incidents where students were 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, handcuffs were being put on them to make them an example, you know, to teach them not to be bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were outraged by that because of what had happened. It was, you know, they were for a chocolate bar or for, you know, Latino.
The incident justified the means.
Yeah, a Latino kid fighting a white kid, you know. Of course, the Latino kid gets arrested, you know, and taken to jail. You know, I mean, the mom doesn't even get called. And people don't know this, that in the state of California, parents don't have the legal right yet to be notified that police are going to interrogate your student, you know, your kid on campus.
Oh, wow.
In the state of Texas, it's mandatory that the administrator must notify the parent and ask, do you want it to move forward or not? Do you want us to wait until you get here, you know, before the police start talking to your child? Now, everybody knows police can legally lie, you know, that they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you're an adult, usually when a police grabs you and, you know, they give you your rights, you know, the first thing is you have the right to remain silent. Okay, so with children, you know, under 18, It's different.
The Miranda rights aren't in play.
They don't read them.
Really?
But if a child says, I want my mom, that's the equivalent of an adult saying, I want my lawyer.
Okay.
Gotcha.
And we see 48 Hours and all these shows. Yeah. Once the person says, you know, I want to speak to my lawyer, you know,
it's over.
The investigators just, you know, close the door and say, okay, that's it. They have to get the lawyer involved.
Yeah.
But they don't do that with children. So for minors, a police can start interrogation, don't read the Miranda rights. But it's just outrageous that in a school setting, when you let your kid go to school, you're expecting them to get an education,
correct,
not an interrogation, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we changed that in our school district, and we advocated for the laws to change in the state of California, passed the assembly, passed the Senate, but no governor has been able to sign that bill, whether they're Republican or Democrat. Why? Because the unions, the Correction Officers Association, the police unions, you know, that mm-hmm. have a tremendous amount of power in Sacramento, they lobby. And they always get their way.
So tell us a little bit more about, like, Let's start from the beginning, I guess, in John Adams.
Yeah. So, you know, I was in elementary school, I was in the gifted and talented and education classes. When I get to John Adams, all the bad influences, you know, start hitting me. So in middle school, so we do such a horrible job in middle school. I mean, I think if you look at all your data, you know, everybody goes down. So white, black, Latino, you know, all, you know, all test scores go down in middle school. I think it's the worst creation, you know, in public education in our country.
Come on, I work middle school and I love it. Yeah. It's like, they say it's like a bourbon, you know what I mean? Like, it's tough at first, but then after a while, it's the only thing you drink, you know what I'm saying? So...
So middle, I mean, for sure, middle school, the students and where the young people are at in terms of their development is a great time because young people are forming their sense of identity.
Yes.
And identity is everything, you know. And so, you know, for me, growing up in a low-income neighborhood in Santa Monica, where there was a lot of, you know, gang influence and poverty and essentially... You know, the identity started becoming sort of like cholo, you know, like gang involved, you know, because it was very prevalent and it was very heavy influence. You know, a lot of my friends, you know, started getting involved. And fortunately, I had hip hop, you know, and breakdancing and all that, which was an outlet for us. But to make a long story short, in middle school, I was in pre-algebra in the 7th grade. And in the 10th grade, I was in pre-algebra.
Oh, shit.
Oh,
so,
man.
There was no academic progress. I was like a CD student. You know, I was, I've been suspended 3 times at John Adams Middle School, you know. So I had handcuffs put on me in the 7th grade. So it was definitely that experience of growing up, you know, in a low-income neighborhood and seeing, you know, feeling the poverty at that point, you know. In elementary school, you don't care what kind of shoes you have or nothing.
Yeah.
In middle school now, you're looking at what, you know, people are wearing and people are talking about you and bagging. We used to call it bagging,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so essentially middle school was kind of like just an eye-opener in terms of my social status, you know, where I was at. The other thing that happened at the end of middle school, there was a crack epidemic that blew up, you know.
Yeah.
And... So, you know, you had essentially 2 types of addicts in the community. You know, you had those addicted to the money and then those addicted to the drug. And a lot of young people, you know, who were poor, they started getting involved in the street life, you know, and what was going on at the time. I mean, it was hard to
turn away, dude.
To turn away when someone says, hey, man, you get $500, I can make you $3,000, you know, in one night. You know, so a lot of people started getting involved and. That's when all the problems started. You know, you start seeing, you know, people going to jail and getting heavy sentences. I had a friend of mine that went to juvenile hall, not even for selling crack. He had peanuts. You know, he was selling peanuts, but apparently there was a law that if you sold something that looked like the drug, you know, you would also get in trouble.
Nah.
And so he ended up he did time for that, you know. It was just a lot of crazy stuff. Then the gang banging picked up because, you know, now gang members had money. With the money came the weapons, you know. So it was just a horrible time. I mean, it was the beginning of, like, all the bad stuff. And then really, like, around 10th grade, like, mid-10th grade, I just I witnessed a young man that I grew up with, you know, who was murdered, you know, on my block. And that was just a real traumatic experience because the whole neighborhood came out. We tried to save his life, put him in a car. Police got there. They pushed us back. Ambulance got there. Police didn't let the ambulance get to the young man, you know. The cop looked at me, and I'll never forget his face. He was like, you better start talking, or I won't let the ambulance get to him,
you know.
And so this young man ended up dying. He ended up dying, and my mom was next to me by this time because the whole neighborhood, it was like, you know, 2 in the morning. And then my mom, you know, she had tears in her eyes, and she was crying. And I realized at that point that, you know, if I end up like this young man, this woman's going to suffer for the rest of her life, you know? Or if I end up in jail, you know, she's going to suffer. Like, young people don't usually make the connection between their behavior and the impact it has on them their
people,
life, and other people. But that's just the brain isn't fully developed, you know, at that point. So when I realized that, you know, about 16 and a half, that was like, I went home and, you know, it was just I just couldn't sleep, and, you know, it was a big awakening. You know, it was like I've had moments in my life, you know, where things just went in slow motion, and it's like more knowledge, you know, whether it's my ancestors, you know, somebody's communicating with me, because there's been moments in my life where it's like I have to stop everything I'm doing, you know, and really redirect, you know, change. And that was one of the big moments there. started at that point. It was like I got focused in school, started doing my homework, started playing football. Well, I was always into football, but I got deeper into it, you know, just working out sober, you know, not partying, not hanging out with the fellas, you know, just really just changing my whole life and changing the way I comb my hair, changing the way I dress. You know, it was just a dramatic change. And I got a lot of pushback, you know.
Yeah.
You know, some of the young men in my neighborhood, you know, it's like, oh, you're trying to be white, you know. This one kid's like, hey, man, you know, what's up, Oscar, man? What's up with you, man? You trying to be white? And I was like, I had a backpack on, you know. I had my hair combed to the side, and I turned around. I walked up to him. I put my backpack down. I said, what's up, man? Like, you got a problem with me, man? You know, like, why you say that? You know, and he's like, oh, because, you know, you got the backpack on. You got your hair combed to the side, you know. And I was like, man, I'm just trying to be better. I ain't trying to be white. Like, you know, like, I'm still me. You know, like, you got a problem. We can handle this right now, you know. And he was like, nah, man, you know, I'm just messing with you, man. You know, like, you know, I was in shape, man. I was playing football.
He didn't want none.
Nah. He'd get devoured, you know what I'm saying? Like, that guy would have got hurt, you know. And it was like, but then everybody was like, oh, okay, you know, this kid is no, you know, I grew up tough, man. I mean, it was, you know.
Yeah, but they all noticed that you were making a change.
I was making a change, and I wanted to make a change, but I also didn't want to forget where I came from, you know. Right. I didn't want to be something I was not, you know. And that's been real important in my life, is to be authentic, to be who I am, not to front, not to be a fake, you know, to just be real, you know, with who I am and have dignity, you know. The turnaround was so drastic that I ended up getting elected student body president at the end of my junior year. So I went from I went from serving residential to serving presidential. You know what I'm saying? I got elected student body president. Almost like a third of the school voted for me. I got like 1,000 votes. There was 3 white kids that I was running against, all in the honors placement, you know, program.
Yeah,
and
like
they combined
real them. Good kids.
Real good kids. And then here's the kid who was an at-risk kid, you know, the at-risk youth.
Yeah, fit the stereotype.
Exactly, you know, from the hood, from the ghetto, you know, of Santa Monica, who ended up getting elected student body president. And the story behind that was interesting because I was in a Spanish course, and there was three kids, you know, talking about who the next student body president was going to be, and they were saying why, and you know, this person's going to win, and jokingly, I said, hey, I'm going to run and beat them all. And then one of the kids started laughing. He's like, oh, you know, laughed really hard. He found it really funny. And I turned around and I said,
you got a problem with me?
No.
He puts his backpack down.
Yeah, put my backpack down. No, this time I was just cool about it. I said, oh, you don't think I can do that? He goes, nah, man, you can't do that. He goes, want me to be honest? I go, yeah, tell me what's up. Because I didn't know anything about it. What is this election thing? He goes, number one, you're a jock. Like, the jock community doesn't care. Like, when was the last time a football player ever got elected, you know, student body president? You guys don't care, you know, don't vote, whatever. And then he said, number two, you're not honors placement. The last 3 student body presidents all came from the honors placement program, you know, so they all knew each other. He goes, but number three is more important. He goes, I don't mean to be racist or nothing, you know, but I'm just keep it real. It's like, you know, you're Mexican. And he's like, you know, Mexican kids don't care either. They don't vote, you know. And they don't get involved. He goes, and when was the last time a Mexican kid ever got elected student body president? He goes, go into the ASB room. They have all the pictures of every student body president that's ever been elected at the school. And then around that time, the bell rang. And I was like,
let me see these pictures.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So
I hadn't heard about this.
So
yeah.
I'm gonna walk down. I walked down to the ASB room, went inside. It was open. And it was exactly what he said. You know, you look at, it was all white faces until you get to 1948. Here's what's pretty amazing. 1948 at Santa Monica High School, an African-American student gets elected by his peers, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they shared it. It was like it was like a student body president each semester. But then the next semester, it was a Mexican kid, Manuel Carvajal, you know. So I looked at that and I was like, wow, that's a trip. You know, like, I was kind of proud of the students. I was like, 1948, this is before Brown versus Board.
Yeah. Do that.
And these are white kids that are electing these students of color, you know, an African-American and then a Latino, Mexican-American. But then after that, there was nothing. So from 1948 all the way to like 1989, it was no Mexican faces, a couple of black faces, but just no Mexican faces. And I just remember, like, thinking to myself, I'm going to be up there. You know, I'm gonna change that, you know? I went to football practice, and I told the coach, and the coach was involved. I think he might have been student body president at that school, too. And I told the coach, I said, Coach, I have an idea. You know, I want to shoot by you. He's like, what's up? And I'm like, yeah, I'm thinking of running for student body president. He goes, okay, that's it. He goes, yeah. He goes, you're doing it. So he
So he, I love it.
So he blows the whistle. Yeah, he blows the whistle and he calls all the football players in. You know, he goes, "Oscar has an announcement to make." And I'm like, "Oh shit!" Like, you know, I wanted your opinion on it. You know, not like he was like, "Okay, Oscar, go ahead."
I didn't want an endorsement, but yeah. I got it.
And so I was like, you know, I'm kind of nervous. I'm like, "Oh, I'm thinking of running for student body president," and all the kids started clapping. You know, they were like, "Yeah, man, let's do this. You know, we'll back you up." You know, and I was like, "Man, okay, well, let's do it. How do you do this?" You know, one kid. He's still a friend of mine. He runs a restaurant, Lattice Restaurant, Jesse Lattice. He was on the football team. And this is what really made me go hard is because he came the next day with pencils. And he put vote for Oscar, like on a piece of paper. He made 200. So he obviously spent like 2 to 3 hours doing this, you know, writing vote for Oscar on a little piece of paper and then getting tape and taping it to each pencil. And he brought like 200 of them. And he brought them to school that day. He goes, "Hey, look, you know, I got this for the campaign." And I was like, you know, that was it. That was enough to motivate me. Another graffiti artist, he did a funny one. He put me like in a Pancho Villa sort of outfit, you know, like with with bullets and a hat.
Yeah.
You know, like a sombrero, like,
I love,
you know,
it.
Straight,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
a revolutionary, you know, yeah, Mexicano, and it said wanted, you know, Oscar for president, you know. So that was really cool. Like, I was like, "Man, that's my poster." You know, that was the way to do it. And so, you know, to have graffiti artists, you know, cholos, you know, skaters, you know, kids in the south side of Santa Monica who are pretty much the working class, you know, coming from the working class neighborhoods, all united. You know, it was like black, brown, Latino, Asian. Everybody was united, you know, saying, "Hey, yeah, let's do this." And seeing that I can make a difference, that I, you know, at least throw my hat in the race.
So you become student body president, then what makes you choose to go to college or not join the workforce? Or
well, that's a good question, because you know, I didn't hear about college from my counselors. You know, in the 10th grade, I was encouraged to take auto shop. You know, you know, I'm sure the counselor wasn't thinking he was doing anything wrong. He saw the zip code where I was coming from. You know, he asked me, "What does your dad do?" My dad's a mechanic, you know. So he's like, "Okay, well, we're going to get a trade for this kid. So at least he doesn't get into gangs and drugs. Maybe he has a trade."
Well-intentioned folks.
And as we do these interviews on the podcast, this theme seems to be reoccurring no matter where we go.
It's well-intentioned folks who make the stupidest decisions.
Yeah, so there was no way that this person could envision, you know, that, hey, this guy's going to, you know, get a master's degree, be an elected official in our city, you know. People from my community don't do that very often, you know. So I'm not totally blaming him. I mean, it's just the stereotypes of the time. But what happened is in playing football, I got to interact with kids from the north side of the city. And I started hearing about PSATs. And first time I heard it, I thought it was a party or a drug or something going on. I'm like, "What the hell's a PSAT, man?" You know? And the kid
just gets you wild.
You go do that at 10 a.m., bro?
10 a.m. Yeah. It's definitely, you know, something to experience, you know? So he said, you know, he's like, "Yeah, my mom's going to take us in the morning. You're welcome to come, you know? And come sleep over, you know? We're going to sleep over and then we'll go take the PSAT in the morning." So I was like, that was the first time that I started really thinking about colleges and what you need to do, you know, to prepare for colleges. By the time I'm a senior, I applied to 6 universities and I got denied by all of them except one. So Chico State University, which was the whitest school in the system, it was like 98% white, you know, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They admitted me as a provisional admit. So meaning that you're not admitted,
right,
but you have to take summer school classes and they have an EOP program.
Yep. Yep.
You'll be able to come and take, you know, remedial courses.
I got to San Diego State, bro.
Yeah.
Provisionary.
You?
Yeah. So I was a provisional admit and I did really good in the summer program. And my first year, I ended up making the dean's list as a freshman at Chico State University. Loved it. Got involved with Mecha. You know, I had great mentors. There was a lot of professors that were, you know, very, very progressive in their politics. And, you know, that kind of turned me on to, like, you know, political science.
Mm.
And from there, I got really motivated. You know, just school was everything. I had a dorm room. People used to laugh at me because I had a little piece of paper. I just wrote, you know, BA degree. And I put gum behind it, and I put it in my dorm room wall. Everybody else had like pictures of Budweiser and like girls in bikinis, and you'd walk into my room, and there was nothing on the walls except just bachelor's degree with a piece of gum, you know, stuck on the wall. But then people used to trip out because, like, it's like, okay, you know, I was serious about it, you know. And so it's like, hey, let's go party. And it's like, man, I got a test on Monday, you know. I was really focused. You know, I was a kid who was just super focused, you know. I knew I was on a mission to get my degree. And I did great things, man. I was elected student body president there. I was the first Latino in the school's history elected student body president. Damn. That really opened me up because I was, you know, very active. Proposition 187 in 1994 was the big issue. So we organized walkouts and sit-ins. And it was tough because you're behind enemy lines up there. So Chico State was like, you know, hardcore Republican.
Yeah.
I mean, I had the local assemblyman had a press conference against me on campus. So this guy, because I proposed a $50 donation to the United Farm Workers Union for their scholarship fund. It was symbolic. It wasn't, I mean, 50 bucks.
It's nominal.
Yeah.
But it was the symbolism of it. This guy goes, you know, he ends up having a press conference against me on campus. And it was like big news, you know.
An assemblyman,
you know. Like
the caucasity.
Yeah. But you know, his point was, he said, if the student government makes that donation, I will pass a law, or I will, you know, I'll propose a law to make all student government fees voluntary. So it was eye-opening to be up at Chico State at the time, you know, and close to Sacramento, too. We did a lot of advocacy around student fee increases, and, you know, obviously we were against that.
So what makes the jump from Chico to UT? Because I would never in my mind think, like, I'm a triple alumnus from San Diego State, because I was like, okay, cool, I like the area, whatever, blah, 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 but I never thought I would go to Texas.
So I applied to the it's amazing how one door opens another door. When I was in Congress, I walked into I started visiting all the congressional offices of, like, Mexicano elected officials. So I went to all the, you know, I went to Salomon Ortiz out of Corpus Christi. Mm-hmm. And in there I met a good brother named Gerardo and talked to him, and he goes, hey, I got this pamphlet that just came in our office. It's the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. He goes, here, apply, and I'll give you a letter of recommendation with the congressman's letterhead. I'm like, I can't say no to that.
Yeah.
Went home, started the application, turned it all in, and I got accepted. So I got the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship, and at various universities, and I saw Texas, and I was wanting to study NAFTA. At the time, NAFTA was a big thing. Yeah. So I wanted to understand sort of the economic development of the Southwestern United States, because I've always believed that the Southwest is going to develop different from the rest of the nation,
right,
just because of the demographic shifts that I knew were going to occur, all the mm-hmm. predictions, you know, and we're starting to see it now.
Yep.
And so I was excited about that. You know, what is the relationship between Mexico and the United States when Mexican Americans become a super majority from the, you yes. know, the formerly occupied, you know, territories of Texas all the way to California?
You get the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to choose these universities. And you're interested in NAFTA. So, of course, let's go check out
Austin.
Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm. Austin, Texas, man. It was a great decision, you know, because the LBJ School of Public Affairs is where I was getting my master's degree, mm-hmm. in the University of Texas at Austin, and we're so close to the Capitol. So I had access to legislators. I ended up working with the Senator Gonzalo Barrientos. He represented the area of Austin. There was a case called Hopwood versus Texas. So this is our generation's Bakke case, you know?
Mm.
So in the University of Texas, Cheryl Hopwood sued the university because of their affirmative action policies.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sparked a movement that was also, that I engaged in. I mean, at first, the first protest was mostly all African-American students. And I got involved. And before you know it, I mean, we had a 10,000 people, you know, protest. And we took over the law school. It was just an escalation of issues, you know, around affirmative action, the fight on affirmative action in the state of Texas. I got really involved. You know, we formed a coalition. We formed a group called Students for Access and Opportunity. And we were up against a lot of, you know, just hardcore racism, you know, in the state and the university as well. But what was great is there was professors, you know, there was leaders, NAACP, you know, professors on campus, legislators. And I was just fortunate to be a part of this team of leaders that developed a response to the end of affirmative action. And it was called the Top 10% Plan. And so we had done the research, and I was part of doing the statistical analysis. We found out that if we guaranteed the top 10% of every high school graduating class in the state of Texas admission to the UT system, we would end up with just about the same amount of students that were eligible, you know. And so what happened in California after Prop 209 passed, it was a big dip, you know, in terms of the amount of students admitted to the UC system. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen in Texas because of the law that we passed. Mm. So we were still able to diversify, you know, the admissions. It was amazing because, you know, when we passed this policy, the governor signed it. The governor at the time was George Bush Jr. Mm-hmm. So George Bush was the governor at the time. He had beaten Ann Richards, became governor. And I was invited to the signing party. I ended up, you know, we were, you know, we celebrated because even though we knew that there's no replacement for a policy that takes race into consideration mm-hmm. as one of the factors, it wasn't the only factor. But we know there wasn't a replacement. Like, you can't have a race-neutral response to years of discrimination and racism.
Correct.
So, but it was the best thing that we can come up with at the time, because at that point, you know, the top 10% plan, it wasn't about race. It was just the schools were so segregated in the state of Texas that if you said the top 10% in El Paso, Texas, it's going to be all Mexicanos. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or in certain schools in Dallas, it was all black. So we were able to come up with a race-neutral strategy to ensure that we had a diverse pool of eligible students to enter the UT system. So I was very proud of that work. The governor signed it, shook my hand, you know, ended up, I didn't know he was going to become president.
So, Eazy-E going to the White House with Reagan?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So, Oscar going to meet Bush. Yeah,
meeting Bush. And Bush was interesting because after, you know, he signed it, he was cool. You know, actually, he was, you know, Bush was pretty cool.
After he did a couple lines and said,
yeah, exactly. What's going on? And so Bush, he ends up running for president. You know, he's running for president. And when they asked, you know, what's your position on affirmative action? He's like, well, I don't know about my position on affirmative action, but I know what I'm for. I'm for affirmative access. So he talks about what we did in Texas and the top 10% plan. And I was like watching the TV. I was like, hey, you know,
that's our language.
That's our language. You know, that's our frame. You know, that's you know, we call it students for cool. access and opportunity. And, you know, it was just a big revelation. It's like, look, you know, we can have an impact on the national stage. You know, where when I was a kid, I was like, you know, we can have an impact in our school, you know, and then when I was in Chico, I was like, well, we can have an impact on state policy. And then being in Texas, like, we can have an impact on national policy, you know. So I had a lot of great experiences, you know, opportunities to get me to think about the next step in my life, you know. So after graduating from the University of Texas in Austin, and I was a student activist, you know. People used to laugh at me because, like, man, you know, are you in school or are you here to protest? You know what I'm saying? But what I did is I started working on my thesis statement, just looking at the impact of the Hopwood decision, you know, on admissions policies and scholarships and, you know, what they called retention programs, you know. And so all of my research was done on affirmative action and issues that we were dealing with at the time in the legislature. And of course, being involved with the state legislature working on these policies, I was able to write about all this stuff.
Right.
So I finished a hundred page master's thesis on the impact of Hopwood, you know, in the University of Texas, and strategies to make improvements, and, you know, so it was an exciting time, and it got me to think about what I wanted to do, which was, you know, work with youth. I thought I'd be in a university, probably teaching, but then when I got to Santa Monica, came back to Santa Monica.
That's when the shit hit the fan.
That's when the shit hit the fan. The gang war broke out, and it's like, you know, either I get involved or I don't. But once I decided to get involved, it led to, you know, just a lot of internal politics with the city government, and then it led to the creation of the Pico Youth and Family Center.
So let's talk a little bit more about that then, man. Let's go into the so you start, like, how, so I know how you started the Pico Youth and Family Center out of the chaos that was there.
Yeah, the violence.
Which was dope. Now, was that, this is a super transactional question, do you know how it was funded? Was it funded through the city, like, in blockchain or block grants or whatever?
No, it most likely came out of general fund money.
Gotcha.
Yeah, because we got our start in a, you know, most nonprofits don't start the way we started. We got started 100% funded by the city of Santa Monica.
Wow. Mm.
And it's because it's a wealthy city, and we put a lot of pressure. I mean, when we put 1,000 people marching through the neighborhood, that was a lot of public pressure.
Y'all better listen.
You know, so we opened up our center. Our motto was peace, unity, and social justice. Our mission statement was to do advocacy. You know, we can point at various victories that we've had, you know, in the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. And really, it's transformed the community. I mean, the relationship between the Pico neighborhood and the city of Santa Monica has totally been transformed through our advocacy.
That's sick.
And so, you know, and it's a wealthy city. So if it was in Inglewood, you know, maybe we wouldn't have had the victories that we had here, because mm-hmm. we stepped into this work at the time that the city ended up making a whole lot more money. Mm. You know, tourism, you know, blossomed. I mean, Silicon Beach blossomed.
Yeah.
So in terms of the city's tax base, it increased, and our advocacy fell right in line. We ended up bringing resources. We started, you know, I tell people it's like the Robin Hood approach. You know, you take from the rich to give to the poor.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what advocacy has to do. You know, but you ain't going to do any of that with services alone. I mean, how are you going to solve the gang problem with tutoring?
Right.
You know, none of the.
That's fucking awesome. So tell me more about. I wanted to hop in there, but tell me more about, like, specifically what, in terms of advocacy, how do you set it up and align it? Because there's going to be people listening to this podcast and thinking, okay, that's fucking awesome. How do I do that?
Okay.
How do I do that in my home?
Yeah. So first of all, you have to look at a crisis in your community. For us, it was gang violence, and like they say, every crisis is an opportunity. So you have a crisis, you have gang violence. Usually the response is you have a community forum and all the elders in the community say, we need more police. The police aren't doing their job, you know?
Yep.
And when we started reframing things, when we said, you know, the forum on youth violence and social justice, it was like people paid attention. Like, oh, wait a minute. What are you talking about? You're not even talking about gang violence, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we started shifting people's mind state in terms of like looking at the symptom of the problem versus looking at the root cause of the problem.
Right.
That shift right there was monumental in terms of the work. But, you know, you have to do, you know, the Vigil for Peace, for example, you know, organizing 1,000 people march, you know, knocking on doors. We knocked on doors of mothers who had lost their kids to gang violence, you know, in the 1980s, you know.
Damn.
So because, you know, we know the families, you know, so when we talked to them, they were all in, you know. There was a lot of mothers that said, you know what, this is horrible. That's true. I suffer, you know, in silence, but there's other mothers that are dealing with the same thing. And so when we started uniting all these mothers, everybody was like, yeah, let's do this. Let's do a protest. So the first meeting happens in your living room, you know, with like about 4 people.
Yeah.
And then you tell them, hey, everybody has to bring another person to the next meeting.
Okay.
And now you have, you know, 8 people. You don't need a lot of people, but you just need a minimum of like 6 to 10 people that are really committed, that are interested in learning more, interested in speaking out, interested in bringing awareness, and the people that are most directly impacted by the problem.
Right.
So if you're dealing with an environmental concern in your community, there's something that's polluting people, hurting their life, lungs, you know, cancer clusters,
they have the narrative, the tight narrative.
Yeah, the people that are most impacted by a problem are the people that need to be at the table in the first few meetings, because they're going to speak out passionately, you know, from experience. And that's going to motivate other people, you know, and that's how the process happens. You know, it's just all through just, you know, sacrifice of meetings. Essentially, is how much time are you willing to go knock on a door, invite people to come and meet, talk about the problem. What's great is this: the formula is always simple. It's like problem, solution, action. It's all about, you know, an approach that's going to engage people in an authentic way, you know, and give them a voice. And then once you take that to City Hall or the school board or any governing body that's in charge of spending money, right? Because these are, I always ask people, I'm like, hey, if I tell everybody right now in the room, give me $10, what would you say? You know, so I go around the room and most people are like, hell no, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, some people that know me, that's like, what do you want it for? I'm like, okay, think about this. Some of you said, like half of you said no, half at least want to hold me accountable and say, what is the $10 for?
Mm-hmm.
I'll give it to you, but I need to know where it's going. Every time that you get a paycheck, a third of your paycheck is going to the government, and none of you even ask any of that. I haven't seen any of you at a city council meeting before. Mm. You know, and I'm someone that you know. You're still holding me accountable much more, and how you hold
what you're doing with
accountable with the city council, and they got millions of dollars, but none of you ever go to the city council meeting. So the point is that here these people are elected to distribute this tax base, and we're not getting any of it. You know, and because our voice isn't there. Why is our voice not there? Because they have an election system that forbids us from getting on. You know, it's difficult.
Yeah.
And there's money involved, you know, to run a race. It costs money, you know.
Right.
So once you break all these concepts down, people understand how power works in the city. Then it's like, all right, well, look, but we can change that because they have organized money. Right. But we can organize people. And justice will be on our side. Why? Because what are we organizing for? We're organizing to make positive change in the community. Like, here's the problem that we want to solve, right? We already talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're in the action phase, and we have an obligation to do this for the next generation. We might not win, you know, we might not change everything, you know, in the next 10 years.
But we're taking the steps.
We're going to take the steps, and we're going to plant some seeds, you know, and then hopefully we do our job. There's a next group of leaders that'll carry on, you know, and then we'll end up in a better community.
One of the stories that I wanted to hear, I didn't quite get yet. You were president at the high school. You were AS president at the college. So it seemed kind of natural for you to become a school board member, but what was the calling there?
Did
you step up because you wanted to, or did the community call you up and say, we want you?
So when we opened up the youth center in February of 2002, January of 2002, by March of 2002, we organized a protest. You know, we formed a group called Mothers for Justice. You know, we went to the school board meeting to protest suspensions and expulsions. Basically, we were articulating back then the school to prison pipeline before anybody wrote a book on the school to prison pipeline.
Before it was published and stuff.
So what was interesting is that there was an African-American woman who was on the school board, and she started talking a bunch of crap. You know, she was like, why are you guys calling the group Mothers for Justice? Like, that's just, you know, continuing the stereotype that the fathers aren't involved. And, you know, she was so disconnected from the community. Like, she didn't really know the reality of what's going on. And she happened to be African-American, so it was kind of sad. But the African-American mothers that we were working with, they got really upset. You know, they started calling her Oreo, and, you know, they got up from their chairs and they started walking out. You know, the president of the school board hits the gavel and says, we're going to take a recess, you know, and she came out. She had to apologize for the school board member's comments, and everybody was just really upset, you know. The meeting was going okay until this woman spoke, you know. So then we're like, you know, everybody's upset, and someone said, man, she's running for re-election, you know. Like, we need to get her off. And then someone looked at me, and they were like, Oscar, you should run, you know. And I'm like, I just opened the youth center like 2 months ago, you know.
Like, so this is in 1998?
This is in 98.
Okay.
No, actually in 2002. Because 98 is when we started the movement.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
But in 2002, we opened up the youth center. I just opened the youth center 2 months before. And here I have a group of mothers, black and Latino moms, but it was diverse too. We had white moms, Asian moms. Like, it was a diverse group. Yeah. And they're all looking at me like, you have to run. Like, you're perfect. You have a master's degree. You grew up in the school district. You were student body president of the high school. Like, you just opened.
Have a name.
Yeah. So there is no way that you'll lose. You know, like we will run your campaign. You know, and I was like, well, I was like, couldn't say no. You know, it was like, I'm like, all right, I'm in. You know, let's do this. And we ran a campaign. We didn't really know, you know, what we were gonna how to do it. We came in last that year. So out of four, you know, seats open, I came in fourth, but we ended up defeating that woman that ended up talking all that mess. You know what I'm saying? She lost to our campaign. So I replaced her on the school board.
That's right. I thought I saw that somewhere.
Yeah. And so what happened is
Ballotpedia.
Yeah. So it was interesting. It was interesting that I ended up replacing the woman that was upsetting, you know, these mothers, you know, with her comments at the school board meeting. So that was the beginning of it. And the first issue I took on, of course, was suspensions and expulsions.
That's awesome.
And so I'm proud now that we have restorative justice, because we made the demand back in 2002. We called for restorative justice as a method to deal with student discipline, which is different, right? Like, and I guess restorative justice for me, it was a Native American practice. We actually, before it was called restorative justice, we heard about Native American communities when, you know, young people did something wrong. They would circle the whole, you know.
Here we go. I love this. Now we're going to get into it, bro. I love this.
So circle everybody that has an influence on this child, you know. Mm-hmm. So the parents, of course, the uncles, coaches, teachers, circle up. And then it would be on one side the perpetrator and the other side the victim, you know, like whoever did the wrong, you know. But also the person that who was wronged, you know, and have a discussion and a dialogue about why it happened. You know, if you stole the bike, okay, yeah, I really liked the bike. You know, I saw it. You know, no, I didn't. You know, I did. I made a mistake. You know, I took the bike. Okay, so then, you know, how does it make you feel? You know, it's like horrible because my grandfather bought me that bike. You know, he doesn't have a lot of money. It meant a lot to me. So when I came out and I saw it stolen, it was bad. So people start talking about sort of the decision making. And getting the young people to understand that it has the impact that it has, you know, on other people. And then you go around the circle, people start talking about, you know, well, you know, what can we do to restore the harm done, you know? And the community would come together with a solution, and the person that did the wrong would agree to it and carry out the whatever the ask was. And we were inspired by that method, you know? Instead of, see, in public education, what we do is we get rid of the child because we look at them as problem children. The child is not the problem. The behavior is the problem. But there's a root cause to that behavior. A lot of it is trauma, poverty, you know, all the things that schools don't really know how to grapple with, but must be aware of, you know? But they're not. So then, you know, we want to get rid of the problem and keep the child. We don't want to suspend, because when you suspend a kid, what you're doing is you're getting rid of the child. And then we know all the statistics that say that you know, when children get suspended, they have higher propensity to drop out of school. You know, they get blacklisted. You know, it's just, it becomes very difficult, you know, for a child to rebound, you know, from that experience. You know, they fall back, you know, just you fall behind in school alone.
You're missing school, the benefit, the juice isn't worth the squeeze when you take a student out. For not bringing a pencil or whatever.
Correct. You know, we articulated, you know, that and that catapulted me into school board politics. And, you know, I don't talk about it as much anymore because now we've made some progress. But when I first got elected, every other sentence, every time I spoke, it was institutionalized racism, you know. One superintendent, you know, he said, "Man, Oscar, you know, I admire you because you're really consistent. It gets on our nerves, though, you know, like, I'll be honest with you. It's like to hear everything is institutionalized racism. But I admire you because I know what you're doing. You know, like, you're going to keep on beating that drum until, you know, you have some breakthroughs." Yep. And that's exactly what the strategy was. It was like, look, let's just keep talking about this from that frame. You know, because no one wants to talk about that.
Yeah, that's something that you brought up, and I think, I don't know if people caught on to it. You downplayed a little bit that it's, you know, identifying the problem, then coming up with a solution, and then acting. But in there, I could totally see that there was a lot more nuance in terms of reframing the problem. Identifying first what the actual problem is. Because I think it's really easy for people to go, "Oh, brown kid, you're wrong." That's right. Like, you're not. That's the issue, right?
Or the parents, you know, are bad parents.
Like, correct. Right.
When we first started here, it starts in the home, and these parents aren't doing this. Exactly. Exactly.
Right. So then we find this fascia of like bullshit, and then reframing it, I think, was huge.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us a little bit more about like how important reframing that problem so that people understand? Like, because you made a pass at it, but I want to see if I can dig deeper.
Yeah, in that group of 6 or 10 that you were talking about, I mean, do you have conversations about what the narrative should be when you're going out?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because, you know, think that, you know, there's a narrative that's already out there in terms of like who we are.
Yeah.
You know, so when you say, you know, black youth, you know, it comes so loaded. You know, there's a lot that comes with that. Even when you say achievement gap, you know, there's things that come into your mind about why that's happening. You know, so we have, you know, it's like the same, you know, I'll give you the best example is we talk about, you know, the dropout rate, you know, and in America we always, and what that means is, you know, kids are dropping out of school, meaning that they're selecting to leave the public education system for whatever reason. There's many reasons, but when you talk about it as a pushout rate, it's different. So at this point, it's the institution. You're accentuating the problems within the institution versus accentuating the problems within the social conditions of the children.
The onus is now on the institution and not on the kid.
Correct. So to say you're a dropout is that you chose. Yeah. Exactly. Versus you were pushed out.
Or you weren't supported enough to stay in.
Correct.
Right.
This is like interesting. I do this a lot in this, sort of the reframe. It's like when I'll say a word. I like to play this a lot with people. So I'll say violence, and then what comes to mind? And people will say like, I go, just be honest. Like, and the kids will say stuff like a black guy with a gun.
Yeah,
and
brown people.
Yeah. So
masks.
Yeah. So it's interesting.
Clowns.
So violence will be like, you know, police. And some kids nowadays, because of the videos, they say police abuse. You know, police shooting people. That's all in the conscience right now. You know, that's like in the public conscience right now is when you say violence, you're going to get a different response now than you would in 1998 or even 2000. Right. But what's interesting is that no one will talk about pollution as violence, and so, you know, there's violence going on. Every car that drives through on that freeway, they're violently attacking us, you know, with pollution. You know, there's you can't see it, but there's particulate matter, there's contaminants that are coming into your lungs, you know, that are hurting you, that are killing people, at least a real death, you know. So whether it's asthma rates or cancer rates or all that, the food we eat. You know, if you live in a low-income neighborhood, you don't have a Whole Foods or a Trader Joe's, right.
You don't have access to that.
So you don't have access to organic, you know, food. There's what they call food deserts, you know. So you see a bunch of, you know, fast food all over the place, you know. And so that's violence, you know. You know, so there's systemic violence. I mean, the fact that, you know, people are going to jail in higher numbers, you know, for certain infractions where other communities don't go to jail for those infractions. Right. I mean, kids who
are they given probation,
yeah.
Or they're just
kids who are wealthy, you know, they get caught up in drugs, they go to drug rehabs. You know, if you're low income, you know, you go to prison, you go to jail. You know, so in any case, getting people to understand sort of the root cause of it and reframing it, you know, is really the first step. You know, that level of awareness is so important. Mm-hmm. And especially when we look at, you know, like, let's say, for example, you look at public education and we started talking about, you know, the curriculum and who's in the curriculum and who gets to see themselves in a positive way in the curriculum and who's omitted, you know, who's censored by omission.
Whose story is not left out.
Exactly. And now we're getting a lot smarter about it, you know, because of the demographic shift. Mm. So right now, 54% around of all the students in the state of California are Latino alone. So not including blacks or Asians or anybody else. We're already the supermajority. What's interesting about that is that even though we've had this tremendous demographic shift, there has been no real change. I mean, so it's still sad. We were talking about this. We had a meeting last night with members of the Arts Commission because we're right now leading a protest at City Hall. We're protesting a mural that exists at City Hall, which shows it depicts Spaniards in a very, you know, strong position, and it depicts
indigenous people
in a very inferior position. And this is in our city government, so the government. These are public buildings that supposed
to throw some red paint on that shit.
Exactly.
throw brick,
some blood on it.
Exactly.
Throw brick through it.
So what we're trying to do is make a change. And obviously people are saying, you know, well, if you get rid of that image, even though, you know,
what else are we going to get rid of?
Yeah. Yes, they're worried about
their own stories and their own.
Well, the thing is, you know, people
artifacts.
White supremacy benefits people.
Talk to me.
And so, you know, white supremacy is an ideology, you know, that has been promoted through, you know, monuments and curriculum. And, you know, so people are going to fight, you know, anything that's going to get rid of white supremacy because that's what benefits them. You know, that's what they benefit from it. You know, they end up feeling better about themselves. Right. You know, we live in a society where, you know, someone has to put somebody down, you know, in order to feel better about themselves. Capitalism will do that, you know, and so it's very problematic, but, you know, we had this meeting and we were talking about, you know, how this mural should change. Some of the commissioners were open to, like, you know, solutions. You know, well, if we don't get rid of it, what else can we do? Can we do a digital display to, you know, inform people, blah, 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 blah. There was, you know, some good talk around there. And then one person,
which isn't bad. I would prefer the honest dialogue as opposed to just the shunning out of you brown people are crazy.
Exactly. So there's definitely progress in that. Now the other person's position was we're not going to get rid of it because if we get rid of it, it'll crack and it, you know, it's tiles, you know, so you know, you can't get rid of it. And he was like, and by the way, it's public art and it's freedom of speech.
Now, wait a minute. Those are all problematic. Those are all problematic
but
arguments.
So the thing is we were like, okay, first of all, you talk about censorship. We've already been censored. There's nothing positive in terms of public art that depicts us or Native people in a positive way. In fact, it's all negative. So believe me that this freedom of speech argument is bullshit. Why? Because here's the thing. You would not allow a swastika, you know, up at City Hall. You would not allow slaves, you know, the slave master whipping, you know, slaves at City Hall. Like, you there's certain images that I guarantee you right now, bro, you are not going to allow. So this idea of freedom of speech is bullshit. Freedom of speech only exists for people in power, right. You know? For the people that are not in power, there's no freedom of speech. I'll give you a prime example of that. I mean, look, we started speaking up, and what happened? They cut all of our funding, you know, for the youth center. So it's like, you don't have freedom of speech in this country. There is no freedom of speech in this country, you know? So it's a tool, you know, that people use, you know? Because if you really speak truth to power and you're really about making positive change, those people that speak out, what's happened to them? They've all incarceration, right. Infiltration, you know, assassination. I mean, come on, man. You know, people that are really speaking, you know, to make positive social justice, you know, happen in our society, throughout our country, throughout our history, we've seen that those vocal, yes, those people that have been vocal, they, the government, in some cases, plotted, you know, to murder them, mm-hmm. to kill them, you know, and or to destroy their character. So, you know, we have a problem with someone that says, you know, this mural, which is offensive to your people. In fact, it's not even accurate. You know what I'm saying? Because Native American men fought. Like we can put a more accurate depiction of Native American people fighting, you know, for their life. Like it wasn't just that they walked in and hey,
subservient
all the time. So, you know, we have problems with those images. But for somebody to say, even though it's offensive to you, we're going to leave it up because it's America and this is freedom of speech. That's bullshit, because if their group was being depicted in a negative way, they would not, there'd be a problem with it. You know what I'm saying? So it's just, it's one of those things, you know, in terms of getting people to understand, you know, reframing things, speaking out about things, and then you're going to learn something in the process. That's the thing too. It's like, we don't really know everything that we're going to go through when we begin a process. Like, we're going to say, we want to change this. Okay. There's going to be certain lessons in life. Certain life lessons, and one thing for sure though that I always tell people is that, look, we might not change the problem that we want to change, but we're going to change ourselves in the process. So there's an internal process that's going on when you get involved in advocacy, and there's an external process that's going on. So the external is, you know, the advocacy, the things you see in public, you know, the speak outs, the press releases, the protests, you know, the sign that we make, all that kind of thing. That's external. What we don't ever pay attention to is the internal.
How right? the process changes you.
Exactly. And how you engage in this process and how it changes you. What motivates me is, you know, what positive impact can I have, you know, on people, you know? And how can I make a positive contribution, you know, to people's development, you know? And I get to do that, you know, through a youth center. And teachers can get to do that through the classroom. Mm-hmm. The priests can get to do that through the church. You know, institutions are great when your values, you know, you can practice your values and your principles, you know, through what you do in that organization. And so for me, you know, it's just, it's a great thing, you know, for a great lesson for me that I'd like to teach to my kids and to everybody else, you know, that I interact with. It's not about you getting rich, you know, like we live in a society that says, you know, make money, you know, get that money, listen to music, you know, hip hop is corrupted with that, you know, mm-hmm. but there's no happiness in any of that. Right. No one ever teaches you a course in the high school, like, you know, what happened, how to get happy, you know, like everything's about, you know, these values about, you know, get a career, you know, make money.
But join the rat race.
Yeah. And so for me, it's real important, you know, to think about, like, what's your purpose, you know, on this planet? I mean, you know, we're not here forever. You know, you're here for a limited amount of time in terms of our physical, you know, self, like who we are now. We're energy, so we're going to transform. You know, there'll be the long life. We don't know what that leads to, but for sure, one thing I do believe in, I believe that really our true intention on this planet, you know, is to be good to each other, to love each other. I mean, that's all to me in the end. What really matters the most, you know.
That was from Brooklyn. We get it every time. You got me on? Oh. Shout out to all of my crew. East, West, North, South. On the continent, Europe. All abroad, international. It's a lot of things going on, y'all. 21st century is coming. 20th century almost done. A lot of things have changed. A lot of things have not. Mainly us. We gonna get it together, right? I believe that. Listen, people be asking me all the time, yo, Mos, what's gonna happen with hip-hop? I tell them, you know what's gonna happen with hip-hop? Whatever's happening with us. If we smoked out, hip-hop is gonna be smoked out. If we doing all right, hip-hop is gonna be doing all right. People talk about hip-hop like it's some giant living in the hillside, coming down to visit the town's people. We are hip-hop. Me, you, everybody. We are hip-hop. So hip-hop is going where we going. So the next time you ask yourself where hip-hop is going, ask yourself, where am I going? How am I doing? And you get a clear idea.
Most definitely some gems.
Yeah, man. If there's any a person that we've interviewed that hip-hop has meant something to and really shaped their lives, it's been him.
It's a trip. Let's find out a little bit more about how hip hop shaped Oscar.
All right, episode 27.
We need to articulate that. You know, hip hop for me is a tool. You know that we the music we've made. You know, we have more than 100 original songs now under our belt.
That's dope. And with the center,
with the youth center, with
you
the
guys make like center. You guys make like a compilation, right?
Yeah,
and it's completely made by the youth.
Yep.
That's yeah,
that's sick.
So
that's
we have sick. We have like a Malcolm X song, a Cesar Chavez song, like for educators, you know, that want to, you know, integrate the music into their curriculum. And then we've even thought of some crazy concepts. You know, it's like, man, why don't we do a song on like how to get into college? You know, like put a cool beat to it and some good lyrics. And yeah. There was a song by MC Shan and Molly Maw. It's called "The Bridge," and this song, "The Bridge," yeah, it created a lot of controversy back time because the response to that song was KRS-One, you know, with the song
"Bridge is Over."
The bridge is over. And then South Bronx, you know,
South Bronx.
And then the bridge is over and all that. So there was a beef that happened between MC Shan and Molly Maw, KRS-One, and all that. But there's a verse in that song towards the end on "The Bridge" by MC Shan that really. You know, really inspired me, you know, to stay, to finish college. You know, the reason why I put that bachelor's degree, you know, is, and I'm trying to remember the verse, you know, but it was like, you heard just what I said, that they're always holding you back when you want to get ahead. They hold you back because they're not with it. You talk about school, they talk about quitting. Soon you've seen that time goes by, but you spent most of it out getting high. Thought about it much, much later. Could have went to school and been much greater. But you chose to lead that fate. Now you're sucking on a bone when it should have been steak. The whole purpose of the story I told was mainly to inspire you to reach your goal. Stop walking through life as if you were blind. You should reach for your goal because I'm reaching for mine. And like, the bridge. That was it. But that verse right there is like, I heard that, man. Anytime I felt...
Does your board member quote MC Shan? Because if he doesn't, you need to elect somebody who does.
For real. Yeah, I'm sitting here kind of like, woo! What just happened right now?
Yeah. So that was that verse right there really changed my life, you know, like in a way, because it was like the first time I heard, you know, somebody going through what I was going through and someone that said, you know, man, you know, don't, you know, you don't, you know, you gotta, you know, stick to your guns, man. Lead your destiny, you know? If not, you're going to suck on a bone when it should have been steak. It was like... That verse right there revolutionized my thinking in terms of like why I need to be in school, why I need to finish, you know. And it wasn't about like, okay, to get a good job and make money, you know. It was like, man, because we're in a struggle, you know, and we need to do this like so that we can uplift our people. And there was a you know, also being in Mecha, you know, at the university, there was the whole concept of like get your education and go back to the community, you know.
Speaking of which, I was trying to find the tie-in, and it was Brother Chris Emden, Dr. Emden, that we've had on the podcast, professor of Columbia University. He was talking about this recent post that he had on Instagram, which said, quote, education should not be the way out of a neighborhood. It should be a tool for improving it. And I don't think there's anyone much like who exemplifies that, much like yourself, yeah. And Dr. Emden and all these cats who are doing it, man. Like, this is so sick, dude. This is just...
It's giving back. See, that's the thing. Is like, you got to get your education, come back to the neighborhood. And
So before we kind of transition into the... I just have a couple more questions about you as the board member. Because it sounds like you're following the natural progression from board member to city council. However long it takes, it'll happen, right? And so before we leave the educational space, I just wanted to find out, in terms of, as a board member, how important is the role of climate and culture at the school level, at the district level, for PICO, for Santa Monica? How important is climate and culture?
Well,
and
I
then
think,
what do you guys do to like foster that?
There's one superintendent that said culture trumps compliance any day. You know, so you know, if you want to punish people with suspensions, for example, or you want to reward or punish teachers, you know, that you're going to get more bang for your buck, you know, if you change the culture of a place, that, you know, there's an expectation of how we do our work, you know, how we treat each other, how we treat the students, you know. I think, you know, when it comes to school climate, and school culture, it starts at the top. You know, so for example, we have professional development right now on culturally relevant pedagogy, and mm-hmm. so there's a lot of teachers are getting to receive these trainings on how they can integrate sort of different information into their curriculum to make it more engaging for students of color. Mm-hmm. But we don't do that at the top, so like the school board hasn't had one discussion in terms of how we're diverse,
The teachers are getting the information, but
no one above you. So management is not board.
Exactly. Wow. So there's a disconnect, It's like it's almost like we're saying, okay, the teachers need this, this training. But it's like, no, hold on. You should start with you. Correct. Start with the top, because culture,
the adults,
the people that with the most amount of power and influence should be leading. Because if they lead that, then everybody knows that it's real. We just passed in the last school board meeting, and I'm very proud of this, social justice standards. So we have these standards that we're now going to integrate from preschool all the way to 12th grade, and teachers, it's a new set of standards, but it falls in line with ethnic studies, critical race theory, looking at problems in society and then getting young people to engage, actually. So it's pretty amazing that we're serious about it, definitely at the board level. The question is passing the policy is easy, but really understanding it,
and then embodying it.
Yeah, correct. I mean, in the same day that we passed these social justice standards, I was nominated to be vice president of the school board. And I couldn't get the votes. It was just me and another guy that voted for me. And then they voted to have basically two white men that live in the same neighborhood, that represent the same, like north of Montana is the wealthy part of the Santa Monica. Right. And they both represent Roosevelt Elementary School, which is kind of like the north side. And so here we're passing these policies, but then our actions aren't,
they're not congruent with what you're doing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, I think, in public education in general, is that, the board passes a policy, it doesn't trickle down to the teachers, or the teachers believe in something
and the board doesn't adopt it.
So, the more that you can achieve
all three.
Correct. Achieve institutional alignment on a reform effort, right?
Tell me more.
Yeah, so you have this concept that, look, it's going to be systemic, it's going to be system-wide, there's a total buy-in, so the superintendent, we have a sort of like a State of the Union address, we call it convocation, at the start of every school year. So last year, that's what he started off with. He started talking about, these standards, the social justice standards, and then the board passes the policy, there's professional development going on. We need to reflect on where we're at. Sort of like every quarter, there should be a quarterly report to see how are we doing with this reform.
Calibrating.
But aligning, aligning the institution from the top to the bottom. You know what I'm saying?
So I noticed as I was looking at the schools in Santa Monica, Malibu, Unified, that none of them are receiving any money for after school programs. Because it's my understanding that they probably don't qualify for receiving for any of that, right? But I understand that you're a huge advocate of after-school programs. Tell me a little bit about why you believe in after-school programs and how they can impact the core day of instruction.
Well, we have a system where the parents, go to work. Usually they arrive at 9 a.m. or 8:30, and then they get off of work around 5, 5:30, 6 p.m. The kids get out of school at 3. So, that gap between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m., I mean, even statistics show that that's the highest juvenile crime rate in the country is between 3 and 6 p.m.
The critical hours.
Quote. Yeah, the critical hours. So, I think, after-school programs are really important, in terms of students' development, especially for low-income kids. Because if you have a home, you come home, you have a place to do the homework, you probably have a computer, internet access, maybe a maid, to feed you, or you have, your mom, that doesn't have to go to work, she meets you at home or picks you up. There's just a whole dynamic if you have money, if you're middle class or upper middle class or wealthy in this country, that is totally different.
Take care of, yeah.
In my experience, we got out of school at 3. We went home. We saw the homeboys hanging out. There was no mom and dad. Mom and dad didn't come home till 6. By that time, we've been heavily influenced by the people on the block and the influences of the street. We were out in the street for 3 hours. So giving young people enrichment, but not just anything. A lot of times we don't connect like there's no communication between the teachers and the after school service providers.
Yeah. So, more.
You know, it would be amazing if the teachers were meeting like once a month or even once every 3 months with the after school providers to say like, hey, look, these are the lesson plans. We're working on math, you know, right now. These are the if you can do any tutoring support, that there would be a little bit more, you know, coordination, you know, between the in-school curriculum and the after school programming. I think we could do something really amazing. The big problem, I think, in the public sector is the problem of people working in silos and people not communicating. And now with, you know, internet, there's so many solutions, right? I mean, there's a lot of online, everything from FaceTime to, I mean, you name it, you know, Google Docs, you know, there's so much, you know, there's so much technology now. And I think and even our school district, which is pretty well funded, high achieving, we do a horrible job, you know, in terms of coordination. There's not enough. But we do have a lot of services. We're resource rich. And what I've found out is when people are resource rich, like you have more programming, more services, but you have also more of the silos going on, more people working in isolation because there's more of it. You know, there's
so you probably need someone who could like dip in all of them or just be able to herd all the cats to support your students.
Yeah, the concept, the solution is there's actually it's called collective impact. Mm-hmm. So the idea you know, bringing teams together, you know, to solve problems is the only way to go. Mm-hmm. You know, to connect the after school programs with what's going on campus, you know, to build relationships, you know, between people, between law enforcement, you know, and the mother, you know, of the young man that's been in trouble in the past. I think, you know, at one point I remember thinking to myself that part of my job has to be of changing the relationships between people.
Episode 27 of the Educated Guest Podcast. Yo, how you guys enjoying this episode? Your man's is woke.
Dude, it was a trip to kind of like see it. He's a board member. I've never heard a board member speak like that. Like, what? Did you just say that? What?
Did you just start talking about MC Shan and quoting MC Shan in your life, in your early life, as an inspiration for you continuing your education?
What? What just happened?
Your mans did that. Whose mans is this? He's our mans.
Peep it. Check this out.
All right. So we're going to talk about a story that we read on the internet. There were some gang tensions at his old high school, Santa Monica High School, and he brought in some leading community members that might have used to been gang members to speak on campus, and there were tensions with the local police.
Mr. Cartoon, the Mr. Cartoon story. So yeah, check this out. Yeah. You're going to love it.
Let's go.
Tell us how you know Mr. Cartoon.
So in 2005... We had a lot of racial conflict throughout the city of Los Angeles, but Santa Monica was not immune from that. So there was black Latino conflict within the schools. I mean, there was plenty of schools. I mediated conflict in Locke High School, you know, where you know, Latinos went from being 30% of the population to 10 years later being 70% of the population, mm-hmm. and blacks being 30%. So in communities where communities have been totally, you know, transformed around the demographics, right? There's a lot of tension around that. And in Santa Monica High School, we had also black and Latino conflict, you know. Usually starts off around, you know, gang stuff and then spills over into racial stuff, mm-hmm. you know. So the incident, you know, we had like 12 kids fighting and then the administrators tried to break it all up and then like 200 kids like didn't like disobey. It was like 200 kids were like, nah, we ain't going to school. The bell rang, everybody go back to school. Nobody was going back to school. The administrators called police. And the police overreact, you know. So they bring 54 police officers to the campus. They put the school on lockdown, so everybody has to be, you know, in the classrooms. And then they started, you know, dismissing building by building. Mm. The next day, you know, talking to the youth about the root cause of the problem, why it happened, and all that, you know, I said, well, let me bring people that the young people are going to listen to, like the hotheads, the kids that are, you know, gang inclined, for example. They're not listening to the administrators or, you know, guys in suits, you know, they're listening to, you know, guys with tattoos and people that did time in jail, you know, and you know, ex homeboys and stuff like that. So there was a gentleman I knew in the community, Steven Luciano, who's actually 100% Italian, but he's Chicano. He's an ex Chicano gang member.
I love it.
And so he was in the apparel industry, you know, working with different clothing, Joker brand. And, you know, he was a partner with Mark Machado, who's Mr. Cartoon. Mm. And so talking to them, you know, we're like, well, hey, why don't we go talk to the kids? Like, let's go to campus and talk to the kids about, like, why they should not be fighting and how they should be collaborating. And, you know, Mr. Cartoon's like, man, I did tattoos on, you know, 50 Cent and a bunch of rappers, you know, and I can share those stories and, you know, let them know how, you know, our clothing line is, you know, we're successful businessmen. Like, both of these individuals are, like, businessmen successful, you know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? And all using street, you know, culture to make money, whether it's the clothing line and the labels or the tattoos. You know, these both men were very successful. One's a former gang member. Both were former drug addicts, you know what I'm saying, involved in just a crazy life. You know, and both of them are sober, you know, changed their life, they're into their families. So I'm like, you know, of course, you know, that sounds like a great thing. Let's go talk to the youth, you know. There's 20 police officers on campus the next day. So it's like, I really don't see a sort of a threat, you know what I'm saying? It's like with 20 cops on campus, you know, and like 6 to 10 security guards, like, nothing can happen. That's wrong, you know. So we walk on a campus. It's lunch. The
and
lunch hour.
And you're a board member.
And I'm a school board member. Correct.
Okay.
2005. I got elected in 2002. So we're on campus to go talk to the youth. I let the principal. I let the superintendent know. I try to find. We went to the principal's office to let her know. Hey, we want to talk to the kids. She wasn't there. So on the way out, it was the lunch hour. A lot of the kids, you know, they recognized Mr. Cartoon, and they gathered around and. We start talking to them, you know, like, hey, yeah, man, what's up with the violence? And that's not cool, you know, like, you know, we should be united. You know, these gentlemen were saying all the right things. The police are all seeing this whole thing, you know. Then a big old crowd starts forming. Mm-hmm. Then it's like a bunch of Latino kids, but then a lot of the black kids came in. And I knew some of the black youth, you know, so, but the way they rolled up was a little kind of like, it seemed like something can go down, you know. Right. But I went into the black leadership, you know, the youth, and I'm like, hey, look, check it out, homeboy, do me a favor. If y'all can, like, we're going to go to you guys, but if you guys can stay over there where you were at, you know what I'm saying? Because the administrators are going to get, you know, all nervous, you know? And so the black youth like, all right, cool. You know, I got you. You know, they went back. Like, and we talked to Latino youth and they're like, yeah, the Latino youth were like, yeah, man, these fools, man, they try to jump us. And, you know, they had all their stories, you know? Mm-hmm. So we're like, look, man, why do you think it's happening? You know, like, why is it that the two groups that are at the bottom of the barrel in the school, you know, are fighting each other? You know, so we started asking them all the questions. And in the end, it was like, look, we can't be beefing, man. Like, real men talk, you know? Mm-hmm. So you guys got a problem with each other, man, talk about it. You know what I'm saying? If you have a problem with somebody on their side, then, you know, we can form a mediation session. We'll talk about it. You know, we'll squash that beef, bro, you know? Don't make it a racial thing. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And the Latino youth agreed to that. They're like, all right, cool. So then we went and talked to the black youth. And, you know, they were like, yeah, you know, they were cool. Everybody was positive, you know? And as we're talking to the black youth, the police roll up on us and they're like, Oscar, we need to talk to you. And I'm like, what's up? What's going on? It's like, all right, your guests, they can't be here. And I'm like, why not? And like, because they're gang members. I'm all, how do you know that? He's like, because of the tattoos. I'm all, dude, one of them's a tattoo artist. You know what I'm saying? Like, he makes his living making tattoos.
I don't understand.
And then he's like, well, we know one, you know, he's a gang member, da 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 da. And I'm all, he's like, so the cops start, you know, getting really aggressive, you know? And I'm like, listen, man, we're not walking off. I'm like, what's your jurisdiction? Like, I'm on the school board. My jurisdiction is, we're on a school campus right now. Like, I'm doing exactly what mm-hmm. I'm supposed to be doing, keeping the campus safe. Like, what's your jurisdiction over me? He's like, he's like, well, we're gonna arrest them if you guys don't move. Yeah,
these are my guests, homie.
They're my guests. So then what I did is I assumed the position. You know, I put my hands behind my head and I go, if you're gonna arrest them, you better arrest me first, because they're only here because of me. You know, so then. He looked, you know, the kids were like, oh, shit, you know, like, I'm like, all right, I'm under, you know, arrest me then, you know, and the cop didn't put the handcuffs on me. I go, see, you ain't going to do nothing. I'm all. So I said.
Put your backpack down. Yeah. Once again.
Exactly. I said, listen, I go, look, all we're doing is talking to the youth, you know what I'm saying? I go, you guys ain't talking to the youth. You guys are just walking around, you know, like, ain't talking to the youth. We're here to talk to the youth. Like, how's that problematic, you know? Police sergeant was totally being, you know, aggressive, and he's like, all right, well, we're gonna put handcuffs on these guys, you know. So I said, look, I'm all, you know what, I don't want that to happen, because then by this time Mr. Cartoon's like, hey, Oscar, man, like, he starts sweating a little bit, so he's like,
I don't need this in
we
my
don't
life.
We yeah look we're only here to do something positive, bro. Like, if these people are gonna turn it into something negative, we'd rather just bounce. And I'm all, I agree. So then the police officer, okay, walk out that way. I'm like, nah, man, we ain't walking out that way. You ain't going to parade us in front of everybody. We're going to walk out this way. Like, I know the school, you know, I went to the high school. So we walked up the steps into the building, and then, you know, we ended up walking out. The cops followed us, you know what I'm saying? And the very next day, the chief of police, who's now the mayor of Inglewood, you know, Chief Butts, he was Chief Butts at the time, he put out a real nasty letter saying that I almost caused a second riot, which is kind of funny because all riots that have happened in the history of Los Angeles have all been caused by police abuse, you know? So it's like, for him to accuse me that I almost started a second riot, you know?
Piece-ish.
Yeah, man. So the thing is like, he went, you know, he basically said all these nasty things, you know, in the letter, attacking me, saying that I was disrespectful to his officers, that I created a hazard, that it was unsafe what I did. You know, he was real critical about what I did. And then like, we had a school board meeting like 3 days later, and he sent a lieutenant to come, or a captain, to talk crap about me, you know, and to basically say, to tell the other school board members that this school board member, you know, that Oscar did something very wrong, you know, and that he disrespected the police officers and da 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 da. And so anyway, he made an allegation. He goes, the person that Oscar brought, he was talking about Steven Luciano, is a shot calling gang member, and we have evidence that he has ordered assaults against the people, you know. Mm-hmm. So then I ask him, you know, he finished his little talk. I go, if you have facts that this person ordered assaults, why hasn't he been arrested? Like, isn't that a crime? Is it a crime to order an assault as an active gang member? He goes, yes, it is. I'm all, how come he hasn't been arrested? Well, the simple thing for every police officer to say, it's under investigation. Like, it's still under investigation. Okay. So that was his way to get out of that. But he never was arrested for that. It was a lie, you know? And the police just didn't like the idea that they came up to me, told us to do something. I didn't do it, you know. Yeah, maybe I was a little out of line, you know, acting like, okay, you want to put the handcuffs, put it on me. I mocked them in front of the students.
Little showmanship.
Gotcha. But I appreciate it. I think it's well deserved.
In the end, it's like, you know what? Like, you know, who is in the best position to reach these young people?
Absolutely.
Not the administrators, not the police. And so me knowing these young people and how they think and talking to them, actually, I figured if we bring in people that they look up to, that are in the hip hop industry, that, you know, in the apparel industry, their business, you know, successful business people that grew up, you know, involved in violence, you know, and I remember like the power of that. Cause when, you know, one of my guests, you know, Steven told this kid, hey, you know what happens, man? If I hit somebody, and he's like, you'll go to jail. He's like, nah, bro. If I hit somebody, I'll go to jail 25 to life because it'll be my third strike, you know? So think, you know, I'm not that tough guy anymore. I can't be. Because if I swing and I hit somebody, my record, you know, the mistakes I've made and the criminal rap sheet that I have right now is I'll get my third strike, bro, and I'll basically do 25 to life. So I can't hit anybody. As big as I am, and he's, a, you know, at this point, he's a big dude, muscular, you know, like the prison, you know, prison yoked. Muscles yoked up, exactly, tatted up, you know, all on his arms, and, you know, this guy looks like a very intimidating guy, you know what I'm saying? But he's like, I will never hit nobody again. I can't. So wow. You don't want to be, you never, so violence, all it's done is gotten me into a really bad situation. Like, I regret all the violence that I ever did. Mm-hmm. And now I'm trying to live my life in a peaceful way, you know. So for the young people to hear that from a real tough guy, tatted up, ex-gang member, blah, 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 whatever labels you want to put, it really penetrated these young people. It got to them, you know? And so no administrator, no police officer could have had that impact on these young men that were inclined to be tough guys and thugs and da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The only people that can change a culture is leaders of the culture.
Culture.
You see? So I understood all that. And, you know, the intervention that I brought to campus that day, which I think was very effective, it had no room. Like, there was no way to bring in that type of intervention because people were just unaccustomed to it. It's almost like, how do you bring guys with tattoos, you know, to come talk to the youth? Like, these guys are not, you know, it's like society is saying these guys have nothing to say. Like, we should not be bringing these people and giving them any credibility. But in this situation, it's the best.
They had all the credibility.
They have all the credibility. But, you know, we still live in, you know, in a society that isn't accepting, you know. And it's the same thing. We run into these problems when you're trying to bring in a, you know, ethnic studies course on campus. You know, it's like, you know, this knowledge is not, you know, it doesn't have the credibility of the establishment. You know, it's almost like you're bringing in this other information. Like, how's that going to help? When I founded the youth center. And we said, oh, we're going to have a recording studio. And this one lady said, can I just be honest? I go, yeah, go ahead. How is rap music going to help kids? Like, isn't rap music teaching kids to be violent and put down women and all that? I go, and I had to do a lot of education, you know? But that's the whole thing. It's like, now they've opened up three other recording studios. The Boys and Girls Club now stole our model. They have two recording studios. Virginia Avenue Park, the city has another recording studio. It's like, they still don't do what we do with our music and our, because there's a cultural piece that they don't get, you know? But the point is that the people that are directly not benefiting from the system, we have ideas, we have solutions to these problems. But the system isn't embracing those ideas and solutions.
What else? Is there any, are there any parting words, man? Like, I feel like if there's one ask for the listeners of the Educated Guest podcast, like, is there something you want them to walk away from either doing, saying? What's the call to action from you?
You know, reflecting back on where I started learning how to become an activist, you know, how to care more than just for myself, you know, to not just be an individual, but, you know, to think about the collective, the family, the community, the society, the state, the country, you know. A lot of times we get frustrated because even doing work with, you know, what I like to call at-promise youth, not at-risk youth, but youth that are struggling, is that sometimes you give information or you show a lot of support and it seems like it goes in one ear and it comes out the other, you know? And you get frustrated because you don't see immediate progress. Young people, you know, they're products of their environment. There's trauma in their lives. They've gone through some things, you know. They have a hard time sometimes, you know, making the change. It won't be automatic. Mm-hmm. But like one young man told me one time, he goes, Oscar, they're going to get it when they get it. They might be in a hospital bed. They might be paralyzed. They might be in jail, you know. They're going to get it, though, because the truth that you're saying, like if you tell people don't fight, don't get into gangs, don't do drugs, you know, don't be into violence, get your education, like those are all important things that are true. You know, it's like it's a positive thing, you know. But some people, they're not at the time in their life where they can, you know,
accept it.
But they'll get it when they get it, you know. And so the main thing, I think, for educators is to not give up, you know, and to think out of the box. You know, to start thinking, like, you know, learn more about the social conditions, you know, where the young people, what's producing this problem, you know, like, why are kids not engaged, you know? They have to understand that I'm not just here for a job, you know, that I care about them in ways that maybe other people don't. But as a teacher, you know, when the students see you as someone who is willing to struggle with them, you know, to make positive change in their community happen, then those students are going to feel more loyalty, more of a connection. They're going to want to listen to what you have to say.
Dang, dude, you've been super generous with your time, dude.
You've been dropping gems.
Appreciate you spending so much time with us, man. Like, this has been really, really informative and really, really, I'm glad that you're sharing this with the masses because they need to hear it. Well, they hear it from us, but they need to hear it from someone who's actually sitting on a board, you know what I mean? And so I think you're my favorite board member I've ever heard. Oh, there's two. There's two other
ones. We're going to edit that out. One of our board members is going to get mad. He's going to get jealous.
Nikki Seggs is our favorite board member.
That's great.
You know, we're excited that you're a part of the crew now, man.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. And it's great being on the program. And I'm glad that you all are doing this because, you know, educators need a platform, you know. Like, we all need an opportunity to express what we're going through, what we're struggling with, and what's happening in one community, and whatever ideas we have in one community can benefit another community. And people don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, there's all over the country, there's people doing amazing work. There's teachers doing incredible work, you know, closing achievement gaps, you know, doing amazing work all over the country. But if we don't know about it, you know, we can't learn from it.
No one knows.
Exactly, yeah. So you thank you for informing people and bringing awareness to the good work that we're doing out there.
Appreciate it, man.
We appreciate that, man. And on that note, we out.
Simon, gracias.
Thanks, man.
All right.
Hashtag, very aroused.
Fucking awesome.
Tell me more.
That was fucking dope.
I hope you gained something from that episode. It was one of our favorites to record. It was the longest and the toughest to edit. That's why it took so long. I missed you guys.
We love y'all.
And we out. Educated Guest Podcast, episode 27.
Oscar De La Torre.
Santa Monica.
Peace, y'all.
Yeah.